So we've organized the questions and just basically broke them out, and we'll give each speaker a different question here. And gentlemen, I guess if, you know, like the first question I'm going to ask Craig, but if someone else has a burning response that they would like to jump in on, we can do that as well. So
I'd like to respond to that.
Yeah, okay, sorry. But you have to have the mic, though, to respond.
I paid for this microphone, Mr. Bush.
How do we get the mute button on this guy? He doesn't have a mic. Okay, Dr. Hazen. Okay, Craig. This is regarding the testability of Christianity. How would you respond to someone who says Jesus forgiving sins cannot be tested in reference to your example about the paraplegic?
Yeah, so, I think that's exactly the point, that it if somebody says your sins are forgiven, we just don't have any physical means of testing that. I mean, you don't go into the doctor in a state of unforgiveness, right? He prays for you, and so you receive some sort of forgiveness. Then he puts you, in a CAT scanner, an MRI machine, to find out if there's any physical change. No, there's no physical change going on. It's a spiritual act. The real question is it real? Is it real? Is there a real spiritual world that's been changed through you receiving forgiveness? I think there is. And Jesus wanted us to know that there is. And hence, he relates this invisible spiritual act with a physical act in the empirical world that everybody can actually lay their eyes on and see. And as the Greek text says, they were astonished. And I think everybody would walk away from that thinking, all right, maybe this guy can forgive sins. I mean, you're at least one step in that direction after seeing Jesus perform a miracle like that, especially when he intentionally links the activities.
Excellent. All right. John Mark, I'll give you the next one, but you'll have to hand over the mic. There we go. Thanks, Craig.
Okay, it's like karaoke, apologetics karaoke.
There you go. Can we get some
Problem
background music, please?
Problem of evil. Da, 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 da.
Now, this is an easy one, so it should be pretty simple. The discussion of actual / potential infinities in the universe is not infinite because you cannot cross actual infinity. How does that apply to God and his interaction with his creation? Is he an infinite crossing with a finite world?
So that's sort of a coherent question. No, I mean, whoever asked it, the problem with asking a philosopher a question is we actually think about the question, and so that's awesome. It depends on what we mean by infinite, and it depends on what we mean by actual, which makes me sound Clinton-esque, but let me take a shot at this. Using I think standard meanings for these terms. Whether an actual infinite can exist is itself controversial inside of philosophy. In other words, can an infinite sequence exist? Some philosophers would say yes. I would say no. I don't believe an actual infinite can exist. Let's assume with Aristotle that that's true. In that sense, God is not, obviously, actually infinite. What God possesses is the potentiality to do what God needs to do or know what God needs to know. Think about it in terms of counting. Does God have to know every number, that would be n plus infinity, simultaneously? That would be to know an actual infinite, one through gajillion. Gajillion is a technical term. If you don't have a PhD in philosophy, do not use it. You'll just embarrass yourself, strain some kind of noetic muscle. So God can know a number, I would argue one, and then from that number, know whatever number God needs to know when God needs to know it. He has the potential to know anything he needs to know in that sequence. But he doesn't have to know the actual numbers until he needs to know them. Does that make sense? Yeah. Well, if you'd like to follow up, if I somehow missed your question, God isn't actually infinite. That would be incoherent.
And that's, I started
Yeah. Think of it in terms of potentiality. There's some number right now. When I was a kid, the highest number was Googleplex or something, and then they needed a higher number, Googleplex plus one or something. And you can come up with that number or the power set of Googleplex, whatever it is you're dealing with. You can always get a higher number. We're not going to run out of numbers, in other words, and we can get more whenever we need them. The government has already proved that with the national debt, right? It just keep generating numbers. God can do the same thing. So you don't have to know every number for to have useful knowledge of them. And in that sense, God is infinitely capable. He has infinite potentiality, but he doesn't have to possess an infinite all at once.
Interesting. Do you guys all grasp that? Okay.
Yeah.
So more research.
Well, you should have had to answer the question. I had to listen to it. And golly, people whining on the front row.
Okay, Mikkel. This one might be a little bit.
Yeah. Why did you give me that question? Mikkel, why do you love your wife?
Let me count the ways.
Yeah. Okay. Without using free will as a main support, how can you argue for the omnipotence of God when dealing with the problem of evil and suffering? So, without using free will as a main support.
I feel better now.
So without appealing to free will, I'll say that it's possible that God has good reasons for allowing this or that instance of evil in the world, even if we don't know what those reasons are. It's possible God has a good reason for allowing this or that instance of evil in the world, even if we have no clue what that good reason is. An illustration that I like to give is when I took my little boy, when he was born, he was not even 1 year old yet. I had to take him to the doctor for a whole bunch of shots. And one day they shot him up with four injections in, two in each leg simultaneously. And I was there helping them. I was holding down my little baby while he was looking at me with these eyes going, "Why are you helping the bad people?" You know? And he's crying and I'm feeling terrible. But I'd rather that he experience some very, very real pain for 2, 3, 4 seconds. Than for us to go do our missionary work and, him get malaria or whatever overseas. Just an example of kind of how God got me thinking about this is like Jojo, my little boy, he had no clue that there was a good reason for allowing that suffering. And I don't think anybody in this world is qualified to say, I don't think God could have had a good reason for that. No matter how bad something is, I don't think we're qualified to say that there's just no way, it's impossible that God could have a good reason for that. Because in order to do that, to evaluate, the evil things that happen in the world, you'd have to say, okay, here's a world where, the actual world, where this earthquake happened, okay? And as a result of that earthquake, people stopped living there, or there were new building codes that were put into place, or whatever. And then here's another world where that earthquake never happened. Okay, here's a world where 9/11 happened. Here are all the ramifications. Here's the exact same world where 9/11 didn't happen, and here's all the ramifications of that. 50 years down the line, 500 years down the line, 5,000 years down the line. And, maybe then you can begin to evaluate, well, here's a world where this happened, where that didn't happen, and, could there have been a good reason? And really, who's qualified to do that? So I guess when the problem of evil is brought up, we could also appeal to what's called the full scope of the evidence. In other words, we don't just say, well, how can there be a God when there's evil in the world? Because that's everybody's problem, right? The problem of evil actually is everybody's problem. It's not just a Christian problem. Atheists have to account for evil. How do we know rape and murder and things like that are actually evil and not just whims and preferences? And they also have to account for the problem of good. Where'd good come from? If there's no should, if there's no creator and there's no way things should be, then how can we say that that shouldn't be the case, right? So rather than saying, okay, there's all this evil in the world, so there's probably no God, the question isn't how can there be a God when there's evil in the world, but how can there be a God when there's evil in the world and we know the universe had a beginning and we know there are objective morals and values in the world and we know that the world is, certain facets of the world have the earmarks of design in it and so forth. So we want to appeal to not only, yes, let's look at the problem of evil and see what the Christian worldview has to say about it, but relative to the full scope of the evidence, there's still more evidence to show that God exists, even if we have to deal with the problem of evil. And if you don't like the Christian answer to the problem of evil, you can go elsewhere and see if that sits better with you, that evil is an illusion, that nobody really suffers, and things like that.
I just want to point out that I love the way you started your answer on that, because very often we don't, people will come at you with questions that I call why would God questions. You know, why would God, you know, allow evil? Why would God, you know, not make my feet bigger? You know, something like that. But I like how you started, because you have to put these things in perspective. Sometimes I spend a good few minutes trying to remind the person that, look, I am a speck of dust on a speck of dust on a speck of dust. And the God I'm talking about is a God who can speak a billion galaxies into existence, you know? So I don't think I'm going to really be able to plumb his mind and understand all his ways. And so you put that as the context, and then you say, all right, but I can't try to speculate with you about these things. You know, that helps just ground the whole conversation in the proper context. God is God, and I am this creature, this infinitesimal speck of dust. And then you can attempt your answer. And it really, it puts kind of a gloss of humility on the whole thing for everybody involved in the conversation. So I liked how you started that.
Yeah. Two things about the problem of evil, because it comes up a lot. Can I point out that if the problem of evil as it's normally presented works, I wouldn't be an atheist. I'd simply be a different kind of theist. The problem of evil is not an argument against the existence of God. Does everyone get that? It's the existence of an all-powerful good God. So, for example, Plato believed in a God. He believed there was evil in the universe and that God did the best he could and simply wasn't capable, given natural laws, of making everything work out to be perfectly rational. Now, I know as a Christian, I want to go further than that, and I want to demonstrate something, but my friends who are skeptics are sometimes deeply confused about what they think they're proving anyway. They so associate theism with Christianity because of the United States and the way they grew up that they forget that the argument doesn't go all the way. Let me put it another way. Sometimes people who don't like apologists point out that arguments for the existence of God, they don't get you to Jesus. True? But it gets you some of the way. If what you're trying to do is refute Christianity, the problem of evil, Christianity of the normal sort, traditional Christianity, the problem of evil works. But just remember what it's doing. Does that make sense? Otherwise, you'll think it's a bigger problem than it is. It's a problem for an all-powerful good God. And since I believe in that, that's a problem. But it's not like, yay, I'm going to be Richard Dawkins the second the problem of evil is deployed. There'd be a lot more work to do. And sometimes people cheat and pretend, if they say problem of evil, that we're all going to become atheists. And that's just ridiculous. I wouldn't be, for example. If I became persuaded there was no good answer to the problem of evil, I'd still believe in God, and I'd probably still be some kind of Christian because of the evidence for things like the resurrection. All I'd decide is God has more limited power than Christianity and the Bible taught me. Now, in fact, I don't believe that because of arguments that are persuasive to me, but let's remember what's at stake. We're not going to fall off the end of the world, even if we're not sure about the answer. Second thing is, when you're asked about the problem of evil and you got towards this, ask a person why they don't have better chairs in their living room. Think about the chair you're sitting on. Is it optimal design? Optimal design for what? Could they have built a more comfortable chair? Tell me. Yes. So did the church perversely buy uncomfortable chairs to keep you awake? I mean, here's the point. A better chair for what? Your living room? If they built a better chair and no one could afford it because they put all their resources into chair making so that the church couldn't exist because it had gold-plated chairs, what would happen? And so you always have to ask somebody who claims that the human body is, for example, badly designed. Okay, give me the alternative design plan in a working human being. Badly designed for what? Compared to what? For what purposes? your chair you're sitting in is really well designed for a whole series of complex things having to do with cost, comfort, appropriateness, the ability to move it, the ability to stack it. All those things have to be taken into account, and that gets towards what you're talking about. It's a complicated question, and usually people just say something like this. Why did God design the eye so you have a blind spot? Okay, give me someone about your size that has eyes that work better than mine, that also is rational, that uses the same amount of energy, that hears well as well, that you didn't take energy away from hearing or thinking in order to see better, see like a hawk. It's an endless problem.
Okay, thanks. By the way, last year we had a whole session on the problem of evil. So the DVD set is worth it just for that that session. Of course, Craig and Mikkel's and the other speaker sessions were good too. Mikkel, who was, I forget the name of the speaker last year who did the problem of evil.
Clay Jones.
Yeah, Clay Jones, that's right. So great,
he's
great
dead
one.
Now, but... No. Yeah, he was hit by a tornado as he walked out. We still don't know why. But we have faith.
He still talks, even without a mic. Yes. It's like, on the video, you're just going to be... No, that's great, John Mark. Okay, Sean McDowell. Why is intelligent design at odds with Darwin's theory of evolution? Can they both be true?
Why is intelligent design at odds with Darwin's theory of evolution? I think to properly understand this question, we have to first define what we mean by Darwinian evolution, and second, what we mean by intelligent design. The difficulty in defining evolution is there's at least six different definitions that can be used for what evolution means. So in one sense, if you open up a dictionary, it's going to say evolution means change over time. Right? Well, if that's the case, all of you have evolved, and we've evolved since we've walked into this room. Your beliefs have evolved, which have caused synapses in your brain and neurons to fire, so your brain has changed. You've probably lost cells. If you go like this, you're losing tens of thousands of cells, you know, that very moment. So evolution, yeah, evolution simply means change over time. Another understanding of evolution might mean what people would call microevolution, which is a small change within a kind, either a species or a particular kind. So like when Darwin went to the Galapagos Island, they found 13 different kinds of finches. And what they've noticed since then, in the 50s, there was a study where they found that over a period of about a decade, there was a drought, and the beak size of these finches changed about, it was really about a millimeter, a tenth of a centimeter. Well, there was change and there's adaptation within the finches, but they're still finches. So it's kind of a horizontal type of evolution. There's other definitions of evolution, but the more controversial one is what we call macroevolution, which were common descent. So all living organisms, all life forms, humans and, you know, whatever animal we can think of, trace back through natural selection and random mutation to a common ancestor. Now, the question is, well, people believed in evolution long before the time of Christ. The ancient Greeks, about at least 500 years before, believed in some kind of evolution. But what they didn't have was a natural mechanism to explain the process. What Darwin co-discovered was the theory of natural selection. So all of Darwinian evolution is based upon nature selects instead of an intelligent being selects. It's an unguided, purposeless process that's driven in nature, not an intelligence that's behind it. Now, the problem is intelligent design, on the other hand, says that you can look within nature and see marks that an intelligent being has been present, whether that's in the fine-tuning of the universe, whether that's in the DNA that's in the cell, or what Michael Behe has famously coined the bacterial flagellum in his book, Darwin's Black Box, is that there's actually empirical signs of evidence within nature. Now, how that process came about, intelligent design proponents will debate and disagree about this. Some, like Paul Nelson and our very own John Mark Reynolds, are intelligent design proponents, but young earthers, you're still a young earther, right? You can actually, his view that explains his book out there, Three Views on Creation, goes into this in depth, and it's a great book to kind of explore the different views on this question. I saw it on the table last night. So people in favor of intelligent design might take an old Earth, they might take a young Earth view, but they all agree that there's empirical signs of an intelligent agent who has worked within nature. Darwin's theory says there's not empirical signs of intelligence, at least within the biological world, because it's all come about by a natural, unguided process. Okay, so in a sense, I think to say that God used evolution is like saying an intelligent being guided an unguided, undirected process, which is really an oxymoron. Now, you might say, well, what if God set the process up and just kind of shielded and guided? Now, what do you have then if he did that? You have an intelligent agent. So the question is not common descent. If we all trace back to a common ancestor, but that's a guided process, then Darwin's theory is false. Okay, so what this means is that all the fossils in the world cannot prove Darwin's theory. This is a powerful point. All the fossils in the world, if you had a chain from, you know, A all the way up till, you know, Z, every single step, that might show there's a common ancestor, but it doesn't in itself explain the mechanism of how we got from A to Z. Either that's a guided process or that's an undirected process, and the evidence in itself cannot adjudicate between one or the other. So I think the bottom line principle is Darwin's theory was, I mean, he said there is no design. I forget the exact quote. Maybe you would remember it. He said there's no more design in natural organisms than basically the wind. It's just a purposeless, unguided process. And yet intelligent design says there's a mind and there's an intelligent agent behind this, although we might not know exactly how this intelligent agent operates. Now, to be fair, there's a philosopher, he's not bad, called Alvin Plantinga. Maybe you heard of him. Actually, I'm just kidding. He's probably one of the leading Christian philosophers today. He has a book that came out, I don't know, maybe 3 or 5 months ago about science and religion, where the conflict really lies. He makes the argument, he believes that Darwinian evolution is consistent in a way with theism. So he would take a different view than I do, but obviously he's wrong. So no, I'm just kidding. I'm just playing. So you might find a little difference on those particulars, but I personally, I think there's a tension between this undirected, purposeless process that Darwinian evolution understood, at least as people like Dawkins defend it, and between the idea of an intelligent agent acting. There's a tension there that makes it really difficult to fit, not to mention the biblical difficulties and the scientific questions as well.
So. Excellent. Thank you. Back to Craig. Could you please explain the scorecard again between Jesus and Muhammad?
Yeah. You see, scooting away. Yeah. Good plan.
Yeah.
The main point of that was that everybody wants a piece of Jesus. Everybody wants to co-opt him and own him. Even in Islam, it's clear, I don't know the exact score, but Jesus emerges as a figure greater than Muhammad himself. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, Jesus was born of a virgin according to Muslim tradition. He was a miracle worker, and he was a prophet. And I think it's only Jesus, but it might be Muhammad who stands at the scales of justice at the end of time. So I don't know the exact score, but the point is that Jesus emerges in Islam as a tremendous universal religious figure. And he does that in other religions too. And so if you're sort of on a religious quest, it makes a lot of sense to check out the religion that has Jesus firmly planted in the center first. That's the nature of the argument.
Okay, thank you. John Mark, this one will be for you. How do dinosaurs come into play with the creation of mankind when history says they roamed the earth before Adam and Eve?
Yeah, that's a good question. Usually the person who asks that question either worries about this themselves or is trying to do a gotcha so that Christians will look silly. So let's step back and ask ourselves what we care most about and what we care least about. I'll get to the answer in a second, but I often get asked questions like, how did Noah get all the poop off the ark? He's floating around. And the problem is, if a person doesn't believe in Noah to start with or an ark, They're simply asking the question to make you look dumb so that you can spend a lot of time discussing poop, which is a hard thing to discuss and not look silly, even though sanitation engineers in the room would point out that thinking about that is a great thing to do. And one of the more remarkable things that humans have done is to figure out that kind of thing. I'm from West Virginia, and indoor plumbing is awesome. Now, what I'm saying is this. There are questions that are central to the faith, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, the existence of God. And then there are questions where reasonable Christians can disagree. One of the questions that reasonable Christians of a very traditional sort can agree to disagree on is the age of the earth. The reason for that is nowhere in Scripture are we given an actual age of the earth. Now, for those of you who are young earth, yes, you can extrapolate ages. There are suggestions about how old the earth would be if you took biblical history straightforwardly. But notice that's different than the claim Jesus rose from the dead, which is a straightforward assertion of Scripture and is central. So you can be a perfectly satisfactory traditional Christian, see C.S. Lewis, and accept traditional geology. So usually when I'm asked a question like this, I would say, well, if traditional science right now tells us that dinosaurs existed gajillion years before humans, and they have a story to tell us about history, I have no reason to start by causing you to doubt that. Let's deal with more central issues first. Now, once you're inside of Christian theism, once you accept the truth of Scripture, that opens up lots of possibilities, including the fact that we've looked at the data wrong, that some bias has crept in, and that there are alternative ways of understanding the data from a creationist perspective. I think there are, and I point you to my friends like Leonard Brand, who's tried to responsibly look at the data and change, get a different view of Earth history, Brand, if you want to Amazon him. Or my friend Kurt Wise, who's a young earth paleontologist who got his degree from Harvard. But notice I don't want to start there because that's not the important issue. And if it's going to stand in the way of your being a Christian because you don't like messing around with alternative views of science, just accept what you've been given because not central to the faith.
Thank you. Mikkel. How do we know Jesus is the Son of God?
How do we know Jesus is the Son of God? Well, we know Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. In Matthew 11, for example, is one example of Jesus claiming to be the Son of God. And then in another passage in Luke 11, Jesus says that the ultimate sign that what he's saying is true, is really from God, would be his death and resurrection. We call that the sign of Jonah. And so I believe that we know that Jesus is the Son of God because, one, he claimed to be the Son of God. And then, two, God confirmed his message by raising him from the dead. And I'll be talking about that later on today.
Quick comment on that. To establish that Jesus is the Son of God, we don't have to show that all the scriptures are entirely inerrant in every single thing that we claim. You can actually look at the scriptures through the lens, kind of we talked about last night, through just a standard historical approach. And one criteria that historians will use is something called double dissimilarity. In other words, if something that Jesus says doesn't seem to be taught early on by the Christians, and it's also not taught by the Jews afterwards, it must originate with Jesus. One of the most common sayings that Jesus had was he referred to himself as the Son of Man. Well, just by using this criteria, most scholars will agree that Jesus spoke of himself as the Son of Man. Now, this is not a claim to him being human. This is actually a claim to divinity. So when he's on trial and they basically say, who are you? And he says, Jesus quotes in his trial, you see at the end of Mark chapter 14, I think verses 61 to 64, he specifically says, you will see me coming on the clouds of heaven like a son of man, which was a quote from Daniel chapter 7, in which a divine figure is coming to judge. So the point is that we don't have to assume the whole Bible's true. If we simply look at the statement of Jesus claiming to be the Son of Man, it's dissimilar from those before and those afterwards, probably comes from the lips of Jesus. He speaks it all the time in each of the Gospels in a different way, which is actually a claim for him to be divine. So,
thank you. All right, Sean. While telling the story of your account with the preachers at the mall, you brought up evidence for evolution that you jokingly used against them. Do you actually not believe this evidence to be factual? I find it surprising that one can dig so deep into biblical evidence and take so much out of it, yet, let me turn the page, to be continued, yet brush aside evidence for evolution that I have found to hold a rather fortified basis. I forget whether you said you previously identified yourself as atheist, but if so, what made you begin rejecting evolutionary evidence that you previously held true?
I was not formally an atheist. I grew up in a Christian home. I did go through a period of questioning where I remember actually sitting at Biola, ironically enough, sitting down with my father in Colorado. And just, I looked him straight in the eyes. We were having coffee. I said, Dad, I want you to know something. I don't know if I believe that this is really true. And I didn't know what my dad was going to say in response. I mean, he spent his life defending it. And his son goes, yeah, I don't know if I buy this. And he did not miss a beat. He looked right back at me and he goes, son, I think that's great. And I literally remember thinking, are you like writing a talk in your head and just pretending to be here? And he goes, no, I sense you want to know truth. If you really seek after truth through your heart, your soul, and your mind, I believe you'll be led back to Jesus. He said, don't reject something just because, you know, you want to rebel like some kids do. Only reject something if you think it's not true. He goes, and your mom and I love you no matter what. And then we went snowboarding or something. I don't remember. So I don't know that I'd ever say I was an atheist. I still believed at that point, but I'd say my belief was very fragile and it was very weak and it was not deeply informed. So, I mean, what I've tried to do is I've read on both sides. I remember sitting on a plane recently against a lady who just chimed in. I was watching a show, and she goes, hey, what are you doing? It was an evolution show, and we got in a conversation. She was a PhD in geology. And I turned to her, and I, you know, and she was amazed like this. She goes, how can you reject evolution? It's beautiful. It's so obviously true. And I said, I just have a question for you. How many books have you read on the other side that challenge your views? Name one. Guess how many she could mention? She couldn't mention any. That doesn't mean I'm right because I've read both sides, but I said I've read Dawkins, I've read Dennett, I've read Sam Harris's works on these issues, I've read Michael Shermer, and I went on and on, specific books, chapter and verse that I've read, Victor Stanger's books, etc. So I feel like I've read a lot of books and I've studied the evidence. If evolution was really true and the evidence was compelling, I would believe it. And I would. And I think like, you know, Dr. Mark Reynolds was saying, what would really follow, right? If there was common descent and part of Darwin's theory was true, would that mean Christianity is entirely false? Not necessarily. I mean, I think Alan Plantinga's right. He said, if atheism is true, Darwin has to be true. It has to be. It's the only mechanism we can even think of to defend naturalism. But if some kind of common descent or some type of evolutionary theory is true, it doesn't necessarily mean Christianity is false. It raises some tension. We have to kind of shuffle things and figure them out. But it certainly means Jesus wasn't God. It didn't mean he didn't rise from the grave. And we have to relook at things in the relationship there. So I mentioned the evidence like DNA being 99.5% similar. I hear that charge all the time, but it's really not true. I mean, really what happens is if people take a certain part of the genome that's actually used for sequencing proteins, then those between humans and apes is something more like maybe 90 or 95% similar. If you take all the genome, then it's probably half of that. But on the other hand, even if it was 99.5% similar, that 0.5% still would represent hundreds of millions or billions of base codes within the DNA. So it'd still be a huge, significant difference. Vestigial structures is the other one I mentioned. I said, well, what about all these like vestiges that are left over, like our back or our molars or our tonsils that used to have a purpose that proves evolution was true? At best, if there's vestiges, that wouldn't prove evolution. That would prove devolution, the opposite. It wouldn't show how we've positively gained certain features. It'd show how we've lost features from the past, which is a very different thing. Now, if you go back in time and you look at the list, I saw one early in the part of the 1900s. They list all these specific things they say have no function, and they prove that evolution is true. Guess what they found? All of them, or almost all of them, they found purposes within the human body. And the most recent one is DNA. If you go back just 5 or 10 years, Darwinists will say there's junk DNA, there's tons of DNA that's a result of this blind, purposeless process where things have been cobbled together which showed it wasn't designed. Well, William Dembski, about 10 or 12 years ago, he said, I doubt that. He goes, I think we're going to find purposes for these non-coding parts of the DNA. And guess what they found in just the past, really, couple, 3 years? Purposes specifically for DNA. And if that's interesting to you, Jonathan Wells has a recent book. I forget the exact title, something like The Myth of Junk DNA that came out this past year. And he just cites, I can't remember how many hundreds of professional journals saying this is totally not true. So I don't believe in evolution. It's not because I have a theological problem with it, although I do. I'm honestly just not scientifically persuaded. There's a book back there I wrote with William Dembski called Understanding Intelligent Design. And we have 2 chapters on challenges to evolution. And we went through textbooks and professional journals and got like the top 15 arguments people give and tried to give a scientific response to it. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You just got me thinking about some really fun material. This idea that people who are really on the other side of the ideological spectrum have really never read very widely is so true. It's an amazing idea. When I went to grad school at the University of California, you know, here I was, this Bible reading, Jesus loving Christian, you know, and sitting around seminar tables with very secularly minded people who wouldn't believe like I would in a million years. But they started to think I was some sort of genius. Why? Because I was such a fresh and original thinker. Well, I wasn't a fresh and original thinker. I was just presenting arguments from very thoughtful Christians that these people had never heard of before. And so present them at a seminar table, and they think I'm a freaking genius, you know? In fact, my whole grad school career really came down to one point. I gave a big departmental colloquium presentation, which was very rare for some of the grad students to do. I got chosen to give this presentation to all the professors and all the grad students and a number of grad students and professors from around the Santa Barbara campus. And this was kind of a make it or break it thing because my topic was modern creationism. You know, I was kind of doing a religious studies profile of it sociologically and scientifically. And the second half of my presentation was let me put on the white lab coat of the creationist scientists and try to give you some of their arguments, these people, you know. By the time I was done, 45 minutes into it, everybody in the room was like, I could become a creationist. That is really good stuff. That is amazing. I had no idea there was that kind of hardcore scientific material behind it and very good reasoning. This actually changes my attitude quite a bit. They had never read on the other side. So when I encounter situations like that, I like to encourage my brothers and sisters in Christ, what in the world are we afraid of? You know, what in the world are we afraid of? Let's learn some good arguments and in a winsome and attractive way, present them to people and see what God does with it.
Excellent. Thank you. We are out of time for the Q&A. I know there's a lot of questions we couldn't address.